Today is Wednesday, the third day of April in the year of 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know and do you care how big tech companies are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at PCRadioShow.org. Our website is PCRadioShow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, which is www.prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Google to destroy collected Chrome incognito mode data. An ongoing lawsuit has questioned Google's continued collection of browsing data from the Chrome browser's incognito mode. Now, as part of a settlement for the case, Google has pledged to destroy that data. Incognito mode in Google Chrome, like private browsing modes in other internet browsers, is designed to throw away any local browsing data on your device, allowing you to browse without data collection from accounts or leaving any browsing history. A 2020 lawsuit took issue with the fact that Google could still capture data while users were in incognito mode, though, and sought damages of $5 billion. In December of last year, it was revealed that Google would settle in the lawsuit, but the terms of the settlement weren't disclosed at the time. Now the Wall Street Journal reports that Google will, as part of the settlement, get rid of a huge amount of data collected from Chrome incognito mode. Billions of data points collected from incognito mode will be destroyed according to the settlement terms, though it's unclear if Google will continue to delete this data going forward, as the existing data is being deleted because it was improperly collected. The settlement will also require Google to make changes to its incognito mode disclaimer to update disclosure about what it collects in private browsing, as well as giving users the option to disable black third-party cookies. Google earlier this year also started preparing an update to the incognito mode disclaimer in Chrome to more specifically call out that browsing data can still be visible to Google itself, as well as adding a toggle to block third-party cookies. Additionally, some of the data that Google previously collected on incognito users will be deleted. This includes private browsing data that is older than 9 months from the date that Google signed the term sheet of the settlement last December, as well as private browsing data collected throughout December of 2023. All told, this amounts to billions of data records, according to court records. Certain documents in the case referring to Google's data collection methods remain sealed, however, making it difficult to assess how thorough the deletion process will be. Google's spokesperson said in a statement that the company is happy to delete all technical data that was never associated with an individual and was never used for any form of personalization. He also noted the company will now pay $0 as part of the settlement after earlier facing a $5 billion penalty. Other steps Google must take will include continuing to block third-party cookies within incognito mode for 5 years, partially redacting IP addresses to prevent re-identification of anonymized user data, and removing certain header information that can currently be used to identify users with incognito mode active. The data deletion portion of the settlement agreement follows preemptive changes to Google's incognito mode data collection and the ways it describes what incognito mode does. For nearly 4 years, Google has been phasing out third-party cookies, which the company says it plans to completely block by the end of 2024. Google also updated Chrome's Incognito Mode splash page in January with weaker language to signify that using Incognito is not private, but merely more private than not using it. The settlement's relief is strictly injunctive, meaning its central purpose is to put an end to Google's activities that the plaintiffs claim are unlawful. The settlement does not rule out any future claims. The Wall Street Journal reports that the plaintiff's attorney had filed at least 50 such lawsuits in California on Monday, though the plaintiffs note that the monetary relief in privacy cases is far more difficult to obtain. The important thing, the plaintiff's lawyer argue, is affecting changes at Google now that will provide the greatest immediate benefit to the largest number of users. Critics of Incognito, a staple of Chrome browser since 2008, say that at best, the protection it offers falls flat in the face of the sophisticated commercial surveillance bearing down on most users today. At worst, they say the feature fills people with a false sense of security, helping companies like Google passively monitor millions of users who've been duped into thinking they're still browsing alone. If you still hold any notion that Google's Chrome Incognito mode is a good way to protect your privacy online, now is a good time to stop. Chromebooks are about to change. Chromebooks were basically nothing more than just Chrome on a laptop. While there are still some limitations when compared to Windows or Mac OS, Google's Chrome OS development continues to be rather impressive. However, Google is gearing up to bring about the biggest change to the platform since its inception. LaCrosse, or LACROS, stands for Linux and Chrome OS. It is an initiative by Google to decouple the Chrome browser from Chrome OS on Chromebooks, essentially running the standalone Linux version of the Chrome web browser on top of Chrome OS. This allows the two binaries to be released independently with some performance resource costs. The purpose of LaCrosse is to extend the lifespan of the Chromebooks and decouple Chrome OS updates from Chrome updates in the future. The LaCrosse update brings several advantages for Chromebook users, including the ability to manage multiple Chrome profiles, similar to the capabilities of a Mac or PC. Additionally, it is seen as a step forward for Chromebook users, especially helpful organizations with large fleets of Chromebooks with various automatic update expiration dates. That's the AUE abbreviation for it. Enabling LaCrosse flags on Chromebook can extend its lifespan, allowing users to continue using their hardware devices safely even after the automatic update expiration date has expired. That's a big deal. This doesn't mean that you will no longer have Chrome on your Chromebook. Instead, it will solve a few of the platform's problems, the biggest of which is the inability to receive browser updates after your Chromebook has reached its automatic update expiration date. It's not important from the standpoint of getting new features, but it is important when it comes to receiving security patches that could compromise your accounts. Decoupling Chrome would allow you to download and install updates for the browser for, hopefully, years to come. Doing so would also greatly reduce the stigma around Chromebooks becoming e-waste after the automatic update expiration date is met. Google has been working on different ways to reduce the e-waste introduced by Chromebooks. The most recent change came in September of last year, when Google announced Chromebooks that have been released since 2019 would receive updates for 10 years. This is a definite improvement over the previous 8-year commitment, but Google isn't done just yet. If done right, you probably won't notice the difference between the Chromebook you're currently using and the best Chromebook after this update is released. That is why this change has taken so long to implement. However, there are a couple of other benefits to having LaCrosse compared to Chrome OS that we have today. For one, you'll no longer need to switch between user accounts just because you have multiple profiles. The same profile switcher that is currently available in Chrome on Windows, Mac OS, and Linux will now be available on your Chromebook. You don't need to deal with logging out of one account and into another when the Chrome browser already has profile switching. Another reason why LaCrosse on Chrome OS is a big deal, you will get a consistent experience across the board. So any other features that you enjoy when using Chrome on other desktop platforms are likely to make their way to Chromebooks. While it's important to reduce the amount of e-waste, there's another reason why this eventual split is vital. Currently, both Chrome and Chrome OS receive an update on a 4-week schedule. However, there are times when an update for Chrome OS is delayed for one reason or another, usually related to a bug that needs to be fixed. The problem here is that if there's a critical security patch that needs to be rolled out, Google can't do so without updating the entire operating system. Whereas if you're using Chrome on Windows, you'll likely see a relaunch to update prompt appear in the top right corner of the browser window. With LaCrosse, Google can push an update to the browser separate from the OS and implement any necessary changes immediately. If all goes according to plan, you'll update your Chromebook one day and you won't even notice the difference. While it's highly unlikely to come in the next stable release, we are expecting Google to make the biggest change to Chrome OS at some point in the very near future. But when it does come, you may not even know. The early release version of LaCrosse is reported to be stable and easy to use, but there may be limitations for school-owned Chromebooks due to admin policies set by IT departments. The project has been in development for a couple of years, and it is expected to go mainstream after Chrome OS release 1.1.6. As of the latest information available, the project is still ongoing, and there are ongoing discussions about its deployment and potential future surprises from Google. Intel confirms Microsoft's Copilot AI will soon run locally on PCs. But first, let's define what is an NPU. An NPU, or Neural Processing Unit, is a specialized processor explicitly designed for executing machine learning algorithms. Unlike traditional CPUs and GPUs, NPUs are optimized for handling complex mathematical computations integral to artificial neural networks. They are not a replacement for either CPU or GPU, but instead work alongside these components to provide better performance. NPUs usually operate on predictive models, such as artificial neural networks, and are developed with specific tasks in mind that relate to machine learning. CPUs are good for serial processing and can handle a few operations at once, while GPUs are designed for parallel processing and can handle thousands of operations simultaneously. NPUs, on the other hand, are optimized for handling complex mathematical computations integral to artificial neural networks, making them more efficient for machine learning tasks. CPUs are essential to all modern computing systems, executing commands and processes needed for the computer and operating system. GPU, on the other hand, are ideal for graphics and high-throughput computations, and they work alongside CPUs to increase the throughput of data and the number of concurrent calculations within an application. NPUs, however, are specifically designed to accelerate the computation of machine learning tasks, consuming low power and improving resource utilization for machine learning tasks as compared to GPUs and CPUs. Well, Windows 12, often referred to as the next-gen AI PCs, will require 40 trillions of operations per second, which is also referred to as 40 TOPS, 40 trillions of operations per second of NPU performance. As previously reported, Microsoft's Copilot AI service will soon run locally on PCs instead of in the cloud, and that Microsoft would impose a requirement for 40 TOPS of performance on the neural processing unit. Intel said that Copilot elements will soon run locally on PCs. Company representatives also mentioned a 40 TOPS requirement for NPUs on next-gen AI PCs. Microsoft's and Intel's new co-developed definition states that an AI PC will have an NPU, CPU, GPU, Microsoft Copilot, and a physical Copilot key directly on the keyboard. PCs meeting these requirements are already shipping, but that is just the first wave of the AI PC initiative. Intel divulged future AI PC requirements in response to questions about potential memory criteria. There's going to be a continuum or an evolution of where the next-gen AI PC with 40 TOPS requirements in the NPU. This will enable us to run more things locally, just like they will run Copilot with more elements of Copilot running locally on the client. That may not mean that everything in Copilot is running local, but you'll get a lot of key capabilities that will show up running on the NPU. Currently, Copilot computation occurs in the cloud, but executing the workload locally will provide latency, performance, and privacy benefits. Notably, Intel's shipping Meteor Lake NPU offers up to 10 TOPS for the NPU, while AMD's competing Ryzen Hawk Point platform has an NPU for 16 TOPS, both of which fall shy of the 40 TOPS requirements. Qualcomm, however, will have its off-delay X Elite chips with 45 TOPS of performance in the market later this year. Microsoft is focused on the customer experience with the new platforms. As such, Microsoft insists that Copilot runs on the NPU instead of the GPU to minimize the impact of battery life. Why can't we just run it on the GPU? Microsoft said they want to make sure that the GPU and the CPU are freed up to do all this other work. They also want to make sure it's a great battery life experience. If Microsoft started running Copilot and some of those workloads on the GPU suddenly, you're going to see a huge hit on the battery life side. While AMD holds a slight lead in NPU TOPS performance, and Qualcomm claims a much bigger advantage in its not-yet-shipped chips, Intel says its roadmap includes next-gen processors to address every segment of the AI market. Intel's Lunar Lake processors will come to market later this year, with three times more AI performance on both the GPU and the NPU than the existing Meteor Lake chips. Intel is already sampling those chips to its partners in preparation for a launch late in the year. Those chips will face off with Qualcomm's X Elite and AMD's next-gen processors. In the meantime, Intel is working to expand the number of AI features available on its silicon. Microsoft's Copilot will run on NPUs from all vendors through DirectML, and having more TOPS will undoubtedly result in higher performance. That means we can expect a TOPS war to unfold, both in silicon and in marketing, over the coming years. Microsoft Office no longer comes with Teams. Microsoft announced it will sell Teams separately from Microsoft Office globally. The move comes 6 months after the company did the same thing in Europe amid an antitrust investigation. Microsoft Teams and Zoom are two of the most popular video conferencing solutions available today. These top providers offer robust, reliable remote meeting solutions for team collaboration and communication. Both Zoom and Microsoft Teams are platforms for conducting virtual events. Microsoft said that it will sell Teams, its chat and video communications app, separately from Microsoft Office to customers worldwide. The move comes 6 months after Microsoft unbundled Teams from Office in the European Union. That split came several months into an antitrust investigation of the products by the European Commission. The Commission opened its investigation into Microsoft bundling of Teams and Office last year, following the 2020 complaint by Salesforce-owned Slack that the bundle was illegal. The Commission said its specific point of concern involves a potential distribution advantage given to Teams by virtue of being bundled with a widely used Office platform by not giving customers the choice on whether or not to include access to that product when they subscribe to their productivity suites, and may have limited the interoperability between its productivity suites and competing offerings. The Commission has not yet published the result of its investigation. If it finds Microsoft in violation of antitrust regulations despite the unbundling, Microsoft might have to pay a fine of up to 10% of its global annual revenue. Microsoft's global revenue for 2023 was $227 billion. The global video conferencing market size for 2023 was only $22.5 billion. Microsoft video conferencing revenue was $8 billion of that, and Zoom was $4.6 billion last year. Microsoft has been hit with a $2.4 billion in EU fines over the past decade for unfairly bundling products together. Microsoft is also under investigation by the European Commission for its relationship with artificial intelligence startup OpenAI. Microsoft has invested more than $10 billion in the company, and according to a report last week by The Information, it's planning to finance a supercomputer for the company that could cost around $100 billion. The company has also made somewhat similar arrangements with other AI startups, including Infection and Mistral. OpenAI and Microsoft planning a $100 billion data center housing an AI supercomputer. It would be called Stargate. Microsoft and OpenAI are reportedly working on a massive data center to house an AI-focused supercomputer featuring millions of GPUs. The Information reports that the project could cost in excess of $115 billion and that the supercomputer currently dubbed Stargate inside OpenAI would be U.S.-based. The report says that Microsoft would foot the bill for the data center, which could be 100 times more costly than some of the biggest operating centers today. Stargate would be the largest in a string of data center projects the two companies hope to build in the next 6 years, and executives hope to have it running by 2028. OpenAI and Microsoft are building these supercomputers in phases, the report says, and Stargate would be a Phase 5 system. A Phase 4 system would cost less and may launch as soon as 2026. The Information source says, and may be looking to start in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin. The system could require several Stargate, could need so much power, at least several gigawatts, that Microsoft and OpenAI are considering alternative sources of power, such as nuclear. Sources suggested a data center of this scale would be challenging partially because the existing designs require putting many more GPUs into a single rack than Microsoft is used to increase the chip's efficiency and performance. That means also devising novel ways to keep everything cool. It sounds like the companies are also potentially using this phase of design to move away from reliance on NVIDIA. The report claims that OpenAI wants to avoid using NVIDIA InfiniBand cables in Stargate, even though Microsoft uses them in current projects. OpenAI claims it would rather use Ethernet cables. Much is still to be determined, though, so it seems like the price and plans could all change, and it's unclear when details will be finalized. The Information also states that it has yet to be determined where this computer will be located and whether it will be built in a single data center or in multiple data centers in close proximity. There have also been reports of Microsoft developing its own networking gear for AI data centers. As AI has taken off, NVIDIA GPUs have been in high demand, so it makes sense that companies like Microsoft and OpenAI might want to have some other options. Microsoft said, "We have always been planning for the next generation of infrastructure innovations needed to continue pushing the frontier of AI capability." Microsoft has poured billions of dollars into its partnership with OpenAI, largely in the form of computing power to run its models. If Stargate or something like it comes to pass, the partnership would only grow deeper as the investments get larger and more complicated. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we spend just a few minutes every week talking about computers, technology, the workplace, and sometimes how it actually impacts you in other ways. All right, so let me take you back in time. I worked for an aerospace manufacturer for a number of years, and I was the sole person responsible for all of the IT within our facility. And what that meant was I needed to be able to do everything on all of the computers everywhere throughout the company. So I had passwords. Accelerated access passwords, which allowed me to go on to any of the workstations, any of the servers, and so forth. But I needed to do something to make sure that everything was workable, everything could still operate should I get hit by a bus. This is a common occurrence, especially in smaller organizations where you don't have 10, 15, 100 IT people. So what I did was I set up something which was, we call it in the industry, a break glass situation. It's where if everything goes wrong and you need to get access to the servers, if something goes wrong with your top administrator or administrators, you have access to everything. Now, what did I do? I set up a document all the way along, and it was really simple. I put it in a public location with a password associated with that document. And only one person held that password. That was me. Well, not really. So what I did was I actually had somebody set up who had access to that password. I said, look, if something happens to me, you need to contact Joe over here, not his real name, but Joe has everything. He knows enough to get to this particular account, to get onto this particular document where everything is laid out in case something goes wrong. He and I, good friends, but we rarely were ever in a situation where Joe and I were in the same place at the same time where we would both be in dire danger so that the company could not proceed forward. So this brings it up to a very interesting thing. What are you doing for your own situation at home? See, what I set up was a duplicate of what we would do in big business. You need to do the same kind of thing. If you suddenly end up with something like, I don't know, pneumonia or bronchitis or whatever, you could be laid up for a long time. What are you going to do if your spouse needs to get at all of the household accounts where you pay the bills or you get paychecks or the different IRS-related information? This is a serious situation. How are they going to know the passwords that you have? How are they going to be able to proceed forward without you? And this is an important concern that everybody needs to be taking into consideration. Yes, my wife comes to me all the time and says, hey, I need to get into this particular bank account information. Well, use this password. We have set up a few different passwords, and it's all lined up and it's all detailed out. It is a discussion that my wife and I have had on a recurring basis. There is a discussion of where do I keep all of these noted down. And I keep these in a secure location in our house. Much like that whole situation with Joe, I have set up a place where if the glass gets broken, then you know how to get in there. You know how to keep everything rolling should I, again, be hit by a bus. You need to be doing the same thing. You need to set this up wherever. Is some burglar coming into your house? They're not going to find it. This is a situation where you need to be planning this all out. What if you don't have a spouse? Well, you need to set this up with perhaps one of your kids. You need to set this up with some relative. You need to say, look, this is where I keep this information. This is where I keep that information. And you document this out. Some people suggest putting this in the freezer. You've got a document that's sitting in the freezer. I've heard of people who will take and they will put a flash drive into a Ziploc baggie, and then they will put that Ziploc baggie into a into a cup of water, and they basically make a big, huge ice cube. There's no way anybody's going to get to this. It's an ice cube hidden in the back of the freezer. But if you tell someone, hey, here's this ice cube. All you got to do is bring it out of the freezer, let it melt on the counter, and you're going to have access to my entire life. Obviously, you want to do this with somebody you trust. You want to do this, again, with a spouse or something like that. But that is that type of access that everybody needs to have. Every business needs to have this. Every different location where you are the sole holder of important information, like passwords, like accounts, like insurance information, all of it. And you put everything into one spot, or maybe even multiple spots. This is all the same kind of thing. It's just like business, except we're doing this and we're applying this to home. I cannot stress enough how important this concept is. Find your own way to do it. Find your own way to keep everything secure and accessible just in case you get hit by a bus. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Reviving an aging laptop with Chrome OS Flex. Technological progress often leaves our current electronic devices feeling sluggish and outdated. Manufacturers understandably prioritize supporting newer models, leaving older devices vulnerable to software obsolescence. However, this doesn't necessitate relegating your once faithful laptop into a storage drawer. By embracing a lighter operating system, you can breathe new life into your retired machine, transforming it into a capable tool for web browsing and essential applications. Historically, Linux distributions like Ubuntu, Debian, and Linux Mint have been popular choices, particularly Linux Mint due to its user-friendly interface and efficient resource utilization. Google's Chrome OS Flex offers a solution for resurrecting dormant laptops. It's crucial to distinguish Chrome OS Flex from its full-fledged counterpart, Chrome OS. While Chrome OS powers Chromebooks, Flex boasts cloud-based management, making it ideally suited for web applications and activities facilitated through the Chrome browser. Google asserts that Chrome OS Flex is compatible with most computers manufactured within the past decade. They maintain a comprehensive list of certified models, all of which adhere to the following baseline specifications: x86, 64 and 32-bit architecture from either Intel or AMD processors, processor and graphic processing units manufactured after 2010, a minimum of 4 gigabytes of RAM, and a minimum of 16 gigabytes of storage space. Provided your laptop fulfills these requirements, the installation process is straightforward, especially when leveraging the Chromebook recovery tool. This browser extension guides you through the creation of a bootable installation drive, ensuring a step-by-step journey. This entire process is user-friendly. By revitalizing your old devices, we not only extend the lifespan, but also contribute to environmental sustainability by reducing electronic waste. While Chrome OS Flex breathes new life into older laptops, it's essential to dive deeper into its functionalities and potential limitations to ensure it aligns with your needs. And Chrome OS Flex is unlike traditional operating systems that rely on locally installed software. Chrome OS Flex prioritizes web applications. These applications operate within the confines of your web browser, eliminating the need for extensive software installations on your device's limited storage space. Chrome OS Flex comes preloaded with essential web applications including Gmail, Google Drive, Google Docs, Sheets and Slides, YouTube, and Chrome Web Store. A curated selection of Android apps are accessible through the Google Play Store. However, it's crucial to remember that not all Android apps are compatible with Chrome OS Flex due to potential hardware or software limitations. While Chrome OS Flex prioritizes web-based applications, it acknowledges the need for some degree of offline functionality. Certain web applications like Google Docs offer offline editing capabilities, allowing you to work on documents even without an internet connection. However, these edits will synchronize once you regain internet connectivity. For tasks requiring strict offline functionality, Chrome OS Flex may not be the optimal solution. Chrome OS Flex leverages the inherent security feature of the Chrome browser, offering robust protection against malware and online threats. Furthermore, Google manages updates for Chrome OS Flex, ensuring your system remains secure with the latest security patches and bug fixes. This streamlined approach to update eliminates the user burden of manually searching and installing updates, a common challenge with traditional operating systems on older machines. While Chrome OS Flex boasts minimal resource requirements, it is prudent to assess your hardware's capabilities against your intended usage. Basic web browsing, email management, and document editing will run smoothly on most older laptops. However, resource-intensive tasks like video editing or high-end gaming may not be ideal for Chrome OS Flex on particularly dated hardware. The decision between Chrome OS Flex and a traditional operating system for your older laptop depends on your specific needs and usage patterns. If you primarily utilize web applications and prioritize a lightweight, user-friendly system, Chrome OS Flex is an excellent choice. However, if your workflow demands offline functionality or specialized software not readily available as web or Android applications, a traditional operating system might be more suitable. eMMC versus SSD storage. What's the difference? They have a lot in common, including using NAND flash memory. However, solid-state drives almost always deliver superior performance and are available in far larger sizes for bulk storage. Well, what is eMMC storage? eMMC storage was mostly found in phones as well as cheap, low-cost PCs. The embedded, that's where the E comes from, part of the name comes from the fact that the storage is usually soldered directly onto the device's motherboard. eMMC storage consists of NAND flash memory, the same stuff you'll find in USB thumb drives, SD cards, and solid-state drives, that's SSD, which doesn't require power to retain data. The low-cost nature of eMMC storage made it ideal for cost-effective hardware, including truly cheap budget PCs. How fast is eMMC storage? The latest standard for eMMC storage is version 5.1a, which can effectively deliver transfer speeds of up to about 400 megabits per second. That's not necessarily slow, and SATA SSDs will top out around the same. However, it's not just the overall transfer rate that determines how a device's performance will be affected. Many eMMC storage units can operate with fewer memory gates than an SSD, meaning they can still deliver at the same speed, but with a trade-off of offering less volume. This is why SSD become the standard storage type today. Think of it like a road. The more lanes there are, the more cars you can move at a time. eMMC is a single lane each way, while an SSD is a multi-lane highway. You'll go the same speed on either one, but the on-ramp to get onto the road won't be nearly as slow on the highway. If you like storage that can deliver data as fast as possible, you'll want to check out PCIe NVMe SSD. Some of the best SSDs can reach read speeds beyond 3,500 megabits per second on the PCIe 3.0 standard, while the newer PCIe 4.0 standard can more than double the speed. Write speeds are a bit slow in both cases, but still, much, much faster than eMMC storage. PCIe 5.0 is also on the way, which will push speeds even further. How big does eMMC storage get? If you've been shopping for a budget laptop or tablet, you've no doubt noticed that many come with either 32 gigabytes or 64 gigabytes of storage. These are the most common sizes of eMMC storage. But you can also find 128 gigabyte and 256 gigabyte storage. eMMC storage works best with small file sizes. So if you're often working with large files, you'll no doubt want to look at an SSD. SSDs are available in much larger sizes, usually from 128 gigabytes all the way up to multiple terabytes. They are also usually considerably more expensive. If you're looking at an eMMC drive, always factor in the cost of the cloud storage fees. You'll no doubt end up paying in the end. Sizes like 32 gigabytes and 64 gigabytes just don't hold up anymore. If the price of cloud storage comes out somewhere around the price of an SSD, you might be tempted to pay more upfront and not worry later. There's also the matter of upgrading your own PC after purchase. The embedded part of the eMMC storage means you're not going to be replacing anything. Whereas many laptops, not all, have an accessible M.2 slot. This allows you to choose a smaller SSD, saving money at checkout. You can wait for a sale on your preferred storage and upgrade at your leisure, expanding storage without much trouble. Should you avoid eMMC storage? Cheaper, smaller eMMC storage isn't necessarily bad. There's definitely a market for it, especially in the budget laptop category. It's just that it's a storage option that is definitely getting phased out, so your rig will be outdated sooner if you use an eMMC. As far as durability goes, you'll no doubt see a display or touchpad crap out way before eMMC storage degrades to an unusable condition. Whether or not you should avoid eMMC storage is more based on your budget and what you're using your device for. If you need a tablet or affordable notebook for browsing the internet and watching some streaming media, eMMC storage should be just fine. Keep in mind that eMMC storage is not all made the same, and you'll no doubt want to check reviews for speed benchmarks before making a final decision. Wi-Fi doesn't mean what you think it means. Wi-Fi was coined in 1999 by the same marketing company that came up with the name Prozac. Have you ever thought about where the term Wi-Fi comes from? Most people would logically assume it's a shortened version of some highly technical description for the tech that allowed computers to access the internet wirelessly. But those people would be wrong. The term Wi-Fi isn't an abbreviated version of wireless fidelity, as many people believe. Wi-Fi is a pun on hi-fi, which was coined in the 1950s by audio equipment manufacturers as a shortened version of high fidelity. But there's no such thing as wireless fidelity. It's just a snappy name invented by marketers. TikTok account, That's Pretty Cool, which regularly shares different fun facts, recently made a short video about the origins of Wi-Fi. The comments in TikTok indicate many people were surprised. Other commenters said they didn't like the term when it first came out, which will be a familiar sentiment to anyone who remembers the backlash against podcasts in the 2000s and iPad in the 2010s. The idea that Wi-Fi actually means wireless fidelity has been circulating on the internet since at least 2005. The term was created by the marketing firm Interbrand, which also came up with the brand names for the antidepressant Prozac and the computer company Compaq. The technical term was IEEE 802.11, but that just wouldn't do. Interbrand explains on its website, the name had to be memorable, something universal you can find in your home, the office, a coffee shop, or on public transit, and something that helped consumers intuitively understand the concept. They landed on Wi-Fi, playing off the term hi-fi, which everyone was already well familiar with by the late 1990s. But even though it doesn't inherently mean anything, the branding was incredibly successful at commuting the idea that you could get wireless internet without any kind of cable, which was a radical idea for most American consumers of the 1990s who were just starting to get online in a major way. The name reflects that even without cables, Wi-Fi delivers a high-quality, lossless connection wherever you go. Interbrand writes, since its launch, Wi-Fi has become globally synonymous with wireless accessibility anywhere. It seamlessly enters into languages across the globe. Whenever you need wireless internet, you ask for Wi-Fi. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, I understand you've got some new high-tech stuff to talk about.
Do I ever?
Always.
Oh.
You've come across something called, is this Beamio?
Beamio, yeah.
Okay.
And people are going to care about this tech, you know, maybe not right now, but before long.
Mm-hmm.
It's wireless data communication at a super high frequency, 10 times higher than Wi-Fi.
Okay.
So think about 60 gigahertz in frequency.
Wow. Okay.
And that means, for those of you who ever dealt with radio, a teensy wavelength in what's called the millimeter wave band.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, couple of interesting things about millimeter waves.
Yeah.
One, they don't go through walls.
Yeah, that is so okay, go on.
So if you've got a facility like a school, for example, or a hotel or something where you have a lot of small rooms, you stay private within your chamber, within your wall.
Okay, all right.
Or an office for that matter. Now the other interesting thing is that it's directional.
Okay.
Not, you know, line of sight is important. It's not like a sniper. You don't have to be so accurate that you're going to always be in the center circle, but you have to be pointed pretty generally in the right direction for the two antennas to link up.
All right.
Well, the product I just got from Pathway Design, that's the HoverCam people. They're big players
in
classroom technology. It's called Beamio, as you said, B-E-A-M-I-O. That's the letters I-O pasted on the end of the word B-E-A-M, Beam.
Mm-hmm.
Beamio. So Beamio comes with two modules, a transmitter module and a receiver module. Each has a sticker on it to show you which side the antenna is.
Okay, sure.
So you can point them at each other, pair them, and they're linked up. It's that easy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to get into why that is not just about tech. But let me say first, there are two models. One does full-speed cordless USB-C connections.
Okay.
And the other one makes cordless 4K UHD HDMI connections.
Okay, nice.
So if you have a big room, corner to corner is pretty easy. You want to go to the next room? Sorry, it's not going to go there. Now, let's say that you have a projector.
Mm-hmm.
A big room that you don't always use for presenting things.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you've got big monitors. You've got one source. Could be a notebook. Could be a TV signal, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
If you start running cables around that room, not only are those cables costing a lot, but people trip over those.
So one of the big instant applications that I'm thinking about is actually in churches.
I knew you would think about that.
Yeah, because I've been to a number of even a smaller church. Some of the different churches, you know, you've got the projector way up there, and you're going to run all of this cable and hope that it's not going to fail. And you've probably sunk between labor and the cable and the converters, because HDMI doesn't have a long range to it.
Not by itself. No.
Usually you convert over to SDI. You're going to be spending a grand, a couple of grand. If it's a mid-size, large church, you start racking that up.
And the cables you have are not good. I mean, if you're using cables, especially long cables, they're going to flex. They're going to start to degrade.
Sure. Yeah.
And you're going to see the impact in the result.
Yeah.
And that becomes kind of a forever spending hole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I want to mention, if you ended up with the USB-C version,
and you decided
you need to do HDMI,
mm-hmm.
a standard laptop dock will take care of that conversion for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, those are cheap and all over the place. For the HDMI cable, I think that's just wonderful because, as you say, this is like a totally uncable.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there have been some various forms of, hey, it's wireless HDMI, but it's not that, and it is so slow.
And the Wi-Fi versions are
You're sitting, you're watching a video, and all of a sudden it just shakes up. But with this, it sounds like you're going to have a lot of available bandwidth on this. Up at 60 gigahertz, you're going to be able to shove a lot of data over that.
Absolutely. And look, if you want to check it out, it's about $500 at bhphotovideo.com.
Okay, that's a very reasonable amount. Again, like I said, you know, I'm thinking of one big church down in Southern California, and if I named it off, people would know exactly. I could name off the lead pastor, and he's a famous author. But it's a huge place, and they've got multiple buildings, actually, and they're huge. There's no way you're going to – I mean, the cable runs for that. You're talking right. Getting those big, huge lifts.
Yeah, and if you wanted to do the same thing the next chapel over
– yeah.
You'd never get the bandwidth unless you were hardwired or using millimeter wave.
So this will actually work in outdoor arrangements.
It would indeed.
As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and the Connecticut Tri-State Region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. TED Ed Connect meets Thursday, April the 4th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, April the 5th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. and it's an online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The King's Bight Computer Club meets Tuesday, April the 9th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Park Plaza Restaurant located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. The phone number to call for more information is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting Thursday, April the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, April the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.